At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Welcome to the first day of the rest of the American economy. The Federal Reserve set the table for us yesterday with those rate cuts. Today, inflation's the story. Consumer prices fell last month. Or did they? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. Angie'sList.com. And by Bank of America, believing that healthy communities and a healthy planet are essential to creating opportunities for everyone. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is the 19th of September, a Wednesday, and it's good to have you with us. I'll spare you the suspense and tell you right now that, yes, inflation did slack off last month. For the first time in almost a year, the consumer price index has dropped a tenth of 1%. Roll that in with yesterday's drop in wholesale prices, and it's a nifty economic snapshot. But our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshay reports the picture is actually not quite so clear.
Take a quick glance at the August inflation numbers, and you might think that prices are quite stable. Inflation's hovering a little over 2% a year. But peek under the surface of those numbers, and it's clear Americans have had a bumpy ride recently. Consumers saw unusual price swings in August. That's according to Joel Naroff. He's the chief economist at Commerce Bank.
You know, we have things that are really, really wild. You have food up sharply, you have medical care up sharply, but then you have clothing down, and you have gasoline prices that fell. You have education costs up and computer costs down.
Oil is now surging above $80 a barrel. Naroff says that's likely to push prices up a bit next month, but he doesn't expect a big burst of inflation.
We have businesses around the world who are selling into the U.S., and they want to sell their goods, so they're keeping their prices low, and that's preventing American businesses from raising their prices. And it's this global economy that has really changed inflation.
Robert Stein is a senior economist at First Trust Advisors. He thinks rising oil prices will do much more damage.
So oil's going to cost more, and the things we import are going to cost more, and that drives inflation upwards.
Stein predicts the combination of a weak dollar and expensive oil will send inflation to 4% by the end of the year. That's more than double the rate that the Fed likes and higher than it's been in years. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
In Detroit today, General Motors and the United Auto Workers got back to the bargaining table. They're trying to hammer out a new contract that could be a model for deals with Ford and Chrysler. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports now the two sides are getting creative to solve a critical problem.
The radical idea on the negotiating table is a healthcare trust fund. Harley Shaken is a labor economist at UC Berkeley.
How it's funded is what's different. Rather than a direct contribution by the company would put a big chunk of cash into a trust fund that the union would manage.
How much money GM would put into the trust fund and how it would be financed remain contentious issues. But in broad terms, the trust fund appeals to both sides. Standard & Poor's auto analyst Ephraim Levy says the deal would insulate GM against rising health care costs.
This is about $50 billion in expected future obligations will no longer be on the automaker's balance sheet.
Levy says the union would be protected from the company's financial troubles.
The main goal for them is to lock in having those benefits in case of bankruptcy.
But what works for GM might need some tinkering for Chrysler and Ford. Again, Professor Harley Shaken.
GM has got over 300,000 retirees or dependents. That's over four for each active worker. At Ford, the ratio is 2-1, and at Chrysler, a little above 1-1. That's a very different set of liabilities at each of the companies.
Still, if a deal for a healthcare trust fund is reached, Shaken says it could provide a model not just for Detroit's Big Three, but also for the rest of corporate America. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
We told you yesterday the dollar tumbled against the euro after the Fed's rate cut. What we didn't mention was what might be an even more significant currency story. The Canadian dollar, it's known as the loonie, is within a penny of the greenback. That's something that hasn't happened in decades. And Allison Myers reports now from Calgary it could mean a lift for American retailers.
As the weather in many parts of Canada starts to cool, the natural instinct to seek warmth kicks in. Where better to find that than the hallowed halls of the shopping mall? As the Canadian dollar dabbles with U.S. parity, American retailers are hoping Canadians, like their geese, will head south for their retail therapy. Already, Canadians are shopping online for products they know come cheaper in the U.S., books in particular. On the shelves of McNally Robinson in downtown Calgary, manager Brendan Hunter says the price discrepancies are painfully clear.
I've got one here in front of me, the Michael Connelly's latest book, The Overlook. And there's a substantial price difference in there, $21 U.S. and $27.50 Canadian.
Canadians have been increasingly tempted to head south as the loonie and the greenback dance their parody polka. Now American retailers are hopeful it's their turn to benefit from the potential currency flip. In Calgary, I'm Allison Myers for Marketplace.
That interest rate cut kept on giving. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. You really couldn't pick a group more relieved by the Fed's rate decision yesterday than the big investment banks. Over the past couple of years, they've become some of the biggest mortgage lenders of all. So analysts were watching closely yesterday when Lehman Brothers kicked off Wall Street's earnings season. They were pleasantly surprised with a mere 3% drop in profits at Lehman. But the bloom came off the rose this morning with Morgan Stanley earnings down 17%, almost $1 billion in bad loans they had to write off. We've got Marketplace's Amy Scott on the line from New York to help explain why the disparity. Hi, Amy. How are you?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm well. So we had Morgan Stanley this morning down 17% in earnings. Yesterday, though, Lehman Brothers said 3% plus or minus drop in their earnings. What's the difference?
Well, these are two pretty different firms, but Lehman did mark down about $700 million in loans, so it definitely wasn't immune. Lehman made a lot of money overseas and in other parts of its business, and it also had less exposure to subprime loans than some of the other investment banks. But it's really hard to compare these firms because they have a lot of leeway in how they price certain assets. Some credit-related securities, for example, are hard to value because they don't trade very often and have traded even less lately. I talked to Jack Sizelski, who publishes the Analyst's Accounting Observer. He says a lot of guesswork goes into these markdowns.
Let's put it this way. If you didn't see markdowns, then you'd have a problem. How much faith can you have? I guess you have faith until it's shaken by something that you're suspicious about. And you do that by looking at context and the bigger picture.
And we'll get more context when Bear Stearns and Goldman Sachs report their earnings tomorrow.
And so what are best guesses about those guys?
Well, things are not looking so good for Bayer. Analysts surveyed by Bloomberg News expect to see its earnings per share drop by more than 40%. And Bear Stearns has a lot more exposure to the subprime market than some of these other banks. But Goldman is actually predicted to post a profit because they sold a power company during this quarter.
Let me get a little bit technical on you here, Amy, and back you up for a second to that valuation thing. You know, back in August, when this whole credit squeeze started happening, part of the problem was that nothing was trading, so they couldn't do what's known as mark-to-market, that is, price these assets that they have in all these funds. You're telling me now that here we are a month, 6 weeks later, and this is still happening?
Well, yeah, because it's hard to mark something to market when there isn't a market for the security. So I think analysts are expecting to see a little bit more what they call mark to model or even mark to myth, which is basically guesswork. Unfortunately, we won't know for a while just how they went about valuing these things, but it makes it really hard to compare the different banks because they may look at them quite differently.
As we bathe in the afterglow of the Fed's rate cut announcement yesterday, is there a sense really that we sort of still don't know what we don't know about how the financials, the bank stocks, the ones most exposed to the subprimes, how they're going to fare?
Well, it depends who you talk to. Morgan Stanley actually warned that there would be a couple of quarters of grief. But yesterday, Lehman said they thought the worst was behind us. So, I talked to one investor who's holding on to his investment banking stocks. He thinks they've got enough else going for them that this isn't going to be a long-term concern. But it really depends how quickly the credit market recovers.
So really, we don't know, right?
Exactly.
All right. Amy Scott in New York. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks, Kai.
If you're looking for somebody to thank for those low inflation numbers we told you about up at the top of the program, a quick Chinese lesson might be in order here. Xiexie is Mandarin for thanks, a handy phrase when you consider that cheap Chinese imports have helped keep American consumer prices low for years now. Now, though, China's having inflation worries of its own. Today, Beijing imposed price controls on almost everything from oil and electricity to water and even the cost of parking fees. The rising cost of food, though, is the most worrisome in a country that has 1.3 billion people to feed. But Marketplace's Scott Tong reports it won't only be the Chinese who pay the price.
Food has always occupied a central place in Chinese discourse. Many a conversation starts with a question, did you eat yet? But lately, the chatter has turned to angst over food prices, especially in the countryside. Stroll through an outdoor market in Huai'an. It's about 250 miles north of Shanghai. Everything seems pricier.
It's too expensive. Too expensive.
Ask these chive growers.
We old people can't afford pork. It's already more than $1.50 a pound.
Rural China has felt the effects of rising prices of oil, feed, and fertilizer worldwide. Chinese food prices rose 18% this past year. Eggs are up 24%, and meat has skyrocketed by 49%.
We hardly ever eat meat. We go long stretches without it. But if we have guests, then we'll buy a little.
Meat is seen as a standard by which people think their lives are in fact improving.
Russell Moses is dean of the Beijing Center for Chinese Studies.
And so when you get shortages of pork, people then ask themselves, do I have to make the sorts of difficult choices that I sort of thought I left behind 20 or 30 years back?
Chinese retirees remember the horrific famines of the late 1950s and early 60s. 30 million people starved to death back then. And when they talk about meat, they mean pork. It is not the other white meat out here. In fact, it's so vital that China maintains a strategic pork reserve for supply crises, sort of like the U.S. Strategic Oil Reserve. Hog supplies cratered earlier this year, in part because of a mysterious pig ear disease. Now, breeders are scrambling to raise new piglets, often subsidized by the government. But here in this village, many grumble that Beijing has let them down. It's been a bad rice-growing season because of floods, and there's no social safety net in the countryside when things go bad.
We have no pension. We were farmers when we were young. Now we can't do it anymore. Who takes care of us? Farmers have no guarantee like other workers do.
Russell Moses of the Beijing Center thinks rising food prices add to a level of discontent that many country folk already have. He says they feel left behind in fast-moving China.
They see individuals in urban areas who are able to buy cars, being able to buy more than one apartment, and resentment is in fact growing. Inflation is one of those areas in 88 and 89 that sort of triggered this outburst.
That outburst refers to widespread protests in 1989, culminating in what the government calls the Tiananmen incident. To prevent a repeat scenario, Moses says the authorities are trying to moderate prices. They've capped the price of beef noodle soup in western China at 33 cents a bowl. And they've banned Beijing universities from raising cafeteria prices. The big question is, will rising prices at food markets across China jack up prices for everything else here? It's debatable, but independent economist Andy Xie sees broader inflation coming.
The world needs to be aware that this big China sale that's been going on over the last 10 years is over, and Chinese products are going to become more expensive.
He forecasts double-digit inflation next year, and that could show up in export prices, and eventually the price tags at Walmart. In Jiangsu Province, eastern China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, how's the music industry supposed to compete with piracy?
Get out there and do the work, right? Bottled water competes with free every day. Private schools compete with free every day. Lots of industries compete with free by delivering a better product, a more convenient product.
All right. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 76 points today, 0.5%, to end the day at 13,815. The Nasdaq rose 0.5%, 14 points. Closed at 2666. The S&P 500 ended the day up 0.6%, 9 points at 1529. Accredited Home Lenders powered up 18% today on news it's close to a deal with the buyout firm Lone Star. Countrywide Financial jumped 3% after the company announced its intention to get out of subprimes. Morgan Stanley dropped 2% after it reported earnings this morning. Amy Scott told us about that. But Goldman Sachs rose 2.5% ahead of its earnings release tomorrow morning. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.53%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. In New York, the Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. Officials from the Department of Transportation join the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee to discuss the condition of the nation's bridges. And a House committee holds a hearing on programs to help veterans transition to civilian life. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Fed did its bit to help out the mortgage-induced credit crunch yesterday. Today, federal housing regulators took their turn. They said Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are going to be allowed to dig a little deeper into the subprime pool. The two government-chartered loan companies will be allowed to buy up to $20 billion more in subprime mortgages. Fannie and Freddie are the largest sources of housing finance in the country, and the general idea is that they'll now be able to absorb loans that other investors won't touch. Commentator Robert Reich says that's great and all, but it won't do a thing for the little guy.
A few weeks ago, the president justified his bare-bones plan to help out a few of the millions of homeowners who got caught up in the subprime loan mess, explaining it's not government's job to bail out those who made the decision to buy a home they knew they could not afford. Now, yesterday, the Fed justified its rate cut by citing turmoil in financial markets as a threat to economic growth. Read, bail out the big lenders, credit rating agencies, financial intermediaries, hedge funds, and all the well-paid executives behind them, because they're simply too big to fail. In other words, when it comes to risky behavior in the market, America has a double standard. Average workers and small businesses get clobbered for mistakes like borrowing too much money, yet the big guys with lots more information and experience evaluating risk are let off the hook. It's not just the current subprime mess. Think of the Chrysler bailout of 1979, the 1998 bailout of giant hedge fund long-term capital management, price supports for big agribusinesses facing market downturns. CEOs who drive their company's stock so low their boards eventually fire them get fancy goodbye gifts. Although Home Depot's market valuation dropped 40% during Robert Nardelli's reign, he left with a $210 million golden parachute. But if you're an average worker who gets canned from his job through no fault of your own, you probably won't even get unemployment insurance. Fewer than 40% of job losers qualify these days. Meanwhile, CEOs who screw up can wipe the slate clean. Donald Trump's casino empire has gone into bankruptcy twice, while his personal fortune is protected behind a wall of limited liability. But an ordinary person in trouble can't wipe the slate clean because a new law governing personal bankruptcy makes that route even harder than ever. The subprime mortgage saga is the same old story. The little guys get tough love. The big guys get forgiveness.
The latest book from Robert Reich is called Supercapitalism. He used to be the Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. You can let us know what you think at our website. It's marketplace.org. Concertgoers in Australia got some advice this past weekend from Trent Reznor of the band Nine Inch Nails. Universal Music is upset that Reznor's been raising a ruckus about his tunes being overpriced. A while back, he said it's no wonder people steal music online. But on Sunday, he went a bit further.
Has anyone seen the price come down?
No!
You know what that means. Steal it. Steal away. Steal and steal some more and give it to all your friends and keep on stealing.
Of course, it's the big record labels that complain they're the ones who are being ripped off. Marketplace's Bob Moon concludes our special series now with a look at some ideas that might help the recording industry face the musical future.
Innovation marches on one technological funeral at a time. As Fred Von Lohman of the Electronic Frontier Foundation points out, the music industry once made its money selling sheet music for the family piano.
That may seem quaint now, but it sure did seem like Armageddon to that business when they were facing a player piano that could do this without the need for sheet music. But of course, it unleashed a much bigger, much more exciting music industry that was made possible by recorded music.
Von Lohman has little sympathy for an industry that's been complaining about free downloading for almost a decade now.
Get out there and do the work, right? Bottled water competes with free every day. Private schools compete with free every day. Lots of industries compete with free by delivering a better product, a more convenient product.
He says the attraction of file-sharing sites isn't just that they're free. They offer a far better selection than any pay site, he says, with no restrictions on how files can be copied or played.
You got to give fans what they want. They want the whole catalog. They want it conveniently. And, you know, I think they'd be willing to pay a few dollars for it. But oftentimes you can't really get all the songs, even on iTunes, even if you want to pay for them.
Yes, yes.
John Lennon's solo material, for example, wasn't available until recently and can still only be bought through select websites. And don't bother looking to buy any of the Beatles catalog online. Fans are still waiting for that.
So keep on playing those mind games together.
One mind game facing the industry might be making its music seem to be free. Peter Jenner is a former manager of Pink Floyd who represents an artist coalition in London. He suggests internet service providers should take the lead and make a blanket deal with the recording industry on behalf of subscribers.
It's got to feel free at the margin to the consumers so that you're paying a little bit, but then you can take as much as you like if you're an enthusiast or less if you're not.
Jenner figures adding a few bucks to a monthly internet bill should cover everybody, but why should everyone be forced to pay for what some might not want?
America is the country where you have to pay $2 a month not to make long-distance calls. You know, collective solutions. You pay your taxes so that you can all go to school, even if you're my age.
Others suggest the industry could compensate for free downloading by making money through related merchandising, from ticket sales and T-shirts to product endorsements. Indeed, some music labels have started taking on the management of outside business ventures for their artists. Harvard University professor Felix Oberholzer says between concert revenue and the ubiquitous iPod, one thing is clear.
The industry is actually very healthy. A few of the central players in this industry have not found a new business model that can cope with the new realities.
After comprehensive research, Oberholzer concluded the music giants are wasting time trying to stop free downloading. The Harvard study found no measurable effects on sales.
The link is essentially non-existent, and so I think it's time for the music industry to move on.
The major labels dispute his findings, but Oberholzer contends downloading helps fans learn about new music and might even spur sales if the industry offers added value that gives fans a reason to buy what they can't get for free. Sony BMG and Universal, for example, will soon bundle ringtones along with songs on CD singles. The Electronic Frontier Foundation's Fred von Lohmann hopes that's a recognition that fans can be rallied to buy legitimately.
I don't think we've suddenly had a massive morality shift where tens of millions of Americans who wouldn't shoplift a CD in a store have suddenly lost their moral compass and are rampaging out there eager to break the law.
The recording industry's top lobbyist, Mitch Bainwall, insists it is trying to adapt and support the technologies that fans have embraced, even in the face of ridicule that it's too little, too late.
We are seeking to monetize all sorts of distribution channels. I find it ironic when we do what critics want us to do, we get criticized for that.
Online sales are steadily rising, and Bainwall sees that as a reason to keep on suing unauthorized file-sharing fans. He says that legal pressure helps give legitimate internet sales what he calls the traction they need. He's convinced history will record his industry's tactics as pivotal.
It took some pretty gutsy actions by the music industry and others to establish that, in fact, intellectual property is worthy of protection.
A long, long time ago, I can still remember how that music used to make me smile.
Industry critic von Lohmann has a different take.
I think 10 years from now, everyone will look back at this entire episode with shame. I can't believe it ever got so bad and we were so unimaginative, unable to transition to a new model, that we actually started treating our customers, our fans, as the enemy.
Something touched me deep inside the day the music died.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, you might remember back at the end of the last presidential campaign, Dan Rather was accused of some shoddy reporting on the president's military record. It led to Rather's unceremonious departure from the anchor chair on the CBS Evening News. And now, almost 3 years on, Mr. Rather's putting up a fight. Today, he sued CBS and its parent company, Viacom. Also, Viacom Chairman Sumner Redstone, CBS CEO Les Moonves, and Andy Hayward, the former head of CBS News. Rather accuses them of fraud and breach of contract. He says $70 million ought to make him feel better about the whole thing. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 76 points. That's 0.5%. The NASDAQ added 14 points, 0.5% there as well. The S&P 500 gained 9 points. That is 0.6% there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Imbornoni, Eric Johnson, and Aaron Scott engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, finding big Band-Aids for small elbows and knees.
When people ask me what are the three most important issues facing the Congress, I always say the same thing. Our children, our children, our children.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
Oscar Gomez was a Chicano student activist in the 90s, a radio DJ, and a rising star.
He was fire. He was charisma incarnate. Everyone had a crush on him.
He was a voice of people who didn't have a voice.
Until his sudden and mysterious death. What happened to Oscar? Imperfect Paradise, The Forgotten Revolutionary, wherever you get your podcasts.